I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today's program is in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the civil rights movement on Cape Cod, both historically and present day. But first, WAMU's Rebecca Scheer talks with people who were at Dr. King's 1963 I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C., including the activist leader Julian Bond, who died in 2015.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
You knew you were at a moment of American history. You just knew you were.
This is Sandy Fitzpatrick.
Tell us where we are right now.
We're standing on the very top steps of the Lincoln Memorial, remembering August 28, 1963, which was one of the most exhilarating days of our life.
Our, meaning her and her husband.
Jim Fitzpatrick.
They'd been married 2 years when they attended the March on Washington.
We actually stood right here at the bottom of the steps.
The march was held on a Wednesday.
A gorgeous day, not one of Washington's beastly hot days.
And as Sandy and Jim recall, the crowd...
It was said 3/4 of the audience was African-American, but it was definitely a mixed march.
Was immense.
You turned around and it was just a mass of people on both sides of the reflecting pool and all the way up to the base of the Washington Monument.
Now, a number of civil rights leaders spoke that day.
Whitney Young from the Urban League, Roy Wilkins from NAACP, James Farmer, and John Lewis, who is still a great congressperson in our Congress.
But when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. took the podium,
nobody knew this was going to be one of the great speeches of our history.
It was melodic, it was powerful, it was almost hypnotic.
I have a dream.
There was a rolling quality to it.
That one day on the red hills of Georgia,
like waves,
sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners,
each time it took you to a higher level,
will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood?
He had that ability to raise his audience.
I'd heard him speak many, many times before. He was from Atlanta. I was from Atlanta. He taught me in college.
Julian Bond is, in fact, one of 8 students who studied under Dr. King.
You know, a lot of people say that, but he only taught one time and he only taught one class. So the other people are saying they're just telling a lie, a terrible lie.
These days, after serving in both houses of the Georgia legislature and chairing the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Bond does some teaching of his own.
I'm a professor at American University and the University of Virginia, teaching courses in civil rights history.
But at the time of the March on Washington, Bond had recently helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC.
I was the communications director, which meant I was the publicist.
So on that late August day, he was there, right there, at the base of the Lincoln Memorial.
I do remember that SNCC were the only people who sang We Shall Overcome.
Really?
Yes. There's a picture, there are pictures of us, both moving pictures and still pictures, of us holding hands and singing We Shall Overcome.
But something else Bond remembers, of course, is Dr. King's legendary speech.
He delivered it so well put together. It was just wonderful.
I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream.
This was the rationale of why is there a civil rights movement. It's as if somebody asked him that, and he answered it in this speech.
But my 4 little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
And you couldn't come away from that without having any doubts about why there was a movement and what it wanted.
And Bond says, thanks to that movement, we've come a long way toward making Dr. King's dream come true. But he hopes we don't stop now.
I was part of the last generation in American history to engage in sustained mobilization for civil rights. And I don't want to be the member of the last generation that did that.
So if you were to sort of give a message to this generation, the next generation, what would that be?
I'd say get off your keisters, do something.
And back in 1963, that's what Dr. King's speech inspired so many others to do, such as Sandy and Jim Fitzpatrick.
We knew it was important, and we wanted to be involved in this.
Because after all, they say, Dr. King's dream is, in short, the American dream.
One of the great articulations of the American dream that's ever been spoken.
Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Dr. King inspired many people, including a number of civil rights activists on Cape Cod. Joining us to discuss the history of civil rights on Cape Cod is John Reed, president of the board of directors at Zion Union Heritage Museum and vice president of the Cape Cod chapter of the NAACP. He's also a retired history teacher at Barnstable High School. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Frank Scobo-Rhodes, president of the Cape Cod chapter of the NAACP, former service member in the U.S. Air Force and retired school counselor in Falmouth. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we discuss your personal experiences and some of the present-day civil rights issues, let's remember one of the pioneers of civil rights here on the Cape, and that was Eugenia Forts, who died in 2006 at the age of 94. She's been called the Rosa Parks of Cape Cod and was very active in the civil rights movement for most of her life. So what can you tell us about Eugenia and your interactions with her? John, why don't you start?
Eugenia was the third president of the Cape Cod branch in NAACP. And more importantly, was a fire plug, mainly in the town of Barnstable, but was known all over the country for her activist items. She even participated in a march on Washington and held a sign up, and she's in the DVD or video called Eyes on the Prize. Her sign says Cape Cod. And it's kind of an interesting thing because she was a person that was tireless and took up causes that very few people wanted to take up, particularly in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. What about you, Scobo? What do you remember most about
her? Eugenia?
Yeah.
Oh, I saw the sign she was carrying down at the Washington Monument. I looked at the sign and I said, that says Cape Cod. And I finally got a little closer based on the crowd that was there and said, it does say it's Cape Cod. But I didn't know her at that point. I was in the military. I wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. We were stationed at Otis Air Force Base. Military, you're not supposed to be more than 150 miles away from your post, or you can get yourself into difficulty. So it was something we didn't discuss when we got back.
Yeah.
And we thought about this woman that was carrying a sign. And it wasn't until I saw my father, who was also a resident of the Cape, and I was telling him the story. And he said, well, I know who she is. He said, she can't be any more than that one person. So I said, okay. I left it alone.
Yeah. Now, we have some audio clips from a 1978 interview with Eugenia Forts, courtesy of the Tales of Cape Cod Oral History Collection. In this first clip, Eugenia talks about her first experiences with segregation at age 16. Let's give a listen.
You have been very active in civil rights, have you not?
Very much, yes. I think I have, yes.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, I'll tell you my first experience and how I became involved. We had finished picking cranberries that year, and I wasn't working. I was about 16. So the winter was coming on, and the family was big, and I had to help. So I heard that you could go to Boston and get a job. So I told the family that I thought I'd like to go to Boston that winter, for the fall, after. I think it was around the 1st of November. And see if I could get a job. Well, there used to be trains. We had a depot in Howard, right near the house. and you could go and get the train and go to Boston. It came from Provincetown the whole length of the Cape, and it always stopped in Howard's and News. So I got on the train, and off to Boston I go. Well, they had told me that I could stay at the YWCA in Boston. And so I got the address and everything, and didn't have too much money. If I had $20, it was a lot. I doubt if I had 20, maybe 15. And when I got to the South Station, they had told me to get a cab because I was as green could be. And I told the cab I wanted to go to the Y. And the man drove me there. And when I went to the desk, there was this sweet elderly lady. And she asked me what I wanted. I said, I'd like a room because I'd like to stay in Boston. I came to find work. Oh, she said, my dear, I'm very sorry. She said, but we don't take colored girls here. She said, I think my face must have dropped because I didn't know a soul in Boston. So I said, well, what will I do? She said, well, I'll tell you. She said, we have a nice place for colored girls on Holyoke Street. She said, it's the Harriet Tubman House. She said, I'll call the lady there and see if they will take you. Then she had to call the taxi again, and I was taken to the Harriet Tubman House, and this Mrs. Hill, I'll never forget her, met me at the door, and she made me welcome. And she told me that she had another girl that was there from Ohio who was studying at the conservatory, and that she thought maybe she'd like to have me room with her, which I did. And I stayed in Boston that winter and then came back home.
Did you find a job?
Yes, I did. And I worked in, I think it was Newton that winter, and then I came back home in the spring. But that was my beginning with segregation, and, you know, so I've been very active since.
How do you think these experiences shaped her later work for civil rights and equality?
Well, she went to town meeting, every town meeting that occurred, and sat in the audience. And if there was something that was being discussed that was something that she didn't particularly appreciate, she'd stand up and she told them about it. The most, I guess, the exciting that you could talk about would be the fact that she stood up one night and talked about how hard this furniture was, and it's something that I just don't particularly like sitting on it, and you need to do something about that. Well, they walked into the meeting a couple of nights later, and one of the selectmen said, you know, would you come up on stage, please? And she went up on stage, and they said, well, here's this rocking chair. Would you please try it? Why? She said, because it's going to be your chair if you think that it's something that you'd like to have. And she said, oh, okay. Sat in the chair, said, this feels very comfortable, and said, fine. All you have to do is just ask for it when you come into town meeting.
I have the chair at the museum.
Oh, you do? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I read somewhere that, as you were saying, Scoba, that she would just stand up and say, they'd say when they saw her put her knitting down, they knew she was going to stand up and have something to say. So, John, how did you meet Eugenia?
In an interesting way. I came to the Cape in 1973, and I was going to the University of Mass Amherst. I was at the counseling center, and was told there were a couple of people who wanted to talk to me about a job. I'm saying, a job? Where is that at? In Barnstable. I'm from Boston. I'd never heard of a place called Barnstable. I heard of Hyannis, but not Barnstable. Nevertheless, when I got here, Eugenia was very active, her and Joe Deleuze and Scober and Levi Hill, and they welcomed me in. I didn't know who these people were, never seen them in my life before. But within a short period of time, I began to hear this woman who was older than me anyhow, like my aunt, always speaking up and speaking out on issues. I'm saying, well, who was this lady? Mm-hmm. In Boston, she knew other people in the NAACP there who were prominent citizens in Boston at that time. And I didn't know she was a member of the Boston branch NAACP and used to go back and forth between here and New Bedford and Boston on different causes. She helped integrate Hyannis, that's the other thing, and other places on Cape Cod. Because at first, and Scova can tell you this, there were not very many hotels allowing people of color to stay there. So she had guest cottages and welcomed folks who came, and they stayed in guest cottages. Not just her, but other people as well. But that was the way it was in the early days.
Yeah. We have another clip of Eugenia recalling prominent civil rights leaders who stayed with her on the Cape.
And I'll tell you something that was very nice that happened to me, too. This is a black famous person. For years, you see, with the segregation and blacks couldn't go into hotels, a lot of the black big people, like Thurgood Marshall, stayed with me here. He stayed in my small cottage for three summers. In fact, the briefs for the 54 decision that was rocked the country were all worked on in my house on Mitchell's Way, because Constance Motley and Bob Carter, who were very famous people in the NAACP lawyers, took the cottage for summer of 52 and 53, and they brought all the stuff down to work on it, so that they were all ready for the 54 trial when it came up.
That was prior to Thurgood Marshall going on to the Supreme Court.
Oh, yes. He was with the NAACP then. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, he was out in the backyard one day and relaxed on his chaise, and I said, gee, some folks take it easy. He said, yeah, because when I get back to New York, he said, I think things are going to happen. Well, he got back to New York, and Little Rock, Arkansas sprouted. So, but I've been very lucky. I've known many, many nice people. And as I say, the famous part doesn't mean anything. It's just that they were decent human beings.
When Eugenia died, former Barnstable Town Manager John Clem, who first met her when he was 7 years old, she was the baker in his elementary school, and he told the Cape Cod Times, quote, one week she would be chastising me for a public policy decision, and the next week she would be baking me a pie. She demanded that every one of us, especially those most in need, be treated with dignity and respect. And that's the Eugenia you both knew, right?
That's the Eugenia we both know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what was it like working with her on some of these issues?
It got frustrating because it didn't matter what the rules said. Her attitude was, it can be my way or the highway, and therefore you need to listen to me. When she would go to a national NAACP meeting, I mean, that would be a countrywide conference when she would put her knitting down to stand up. It was,
It got so bad that they used to call me to come to town hall and get her.
Oh, no.
It was like, I had to say to her, that's not the way the meeting runs. You're not on the agenda. Well, God told me to speak, and I'm going to get it told. I could mimic her all day long. And I'm saying, Eugenia, God may be talking to you, but even the rest of them didn't hear it. So you need to follow the script and stick to the plan. When it's your turn in public comment, say what you have to say. But as Scover put it, they gave her 2 minutes. She went on until she got what she needed to be said.
And whatever she wanted to say.
And about them pies. Yeah. At one point in time, I used to go to the store and get the stuff for her to make pies for other people, including Senator Kennedy.
Wow. So you mentioned you came to the Cape in the 1970s, John. Was the Cape different than other places you lived in terms of racial equality?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I came to the Cape when it was still small. Matter of fact, when I went to work at Barnstable High School in 73, there's 1,200 kids there. When I retired, it was 2,500 kids there. When I first came, things were just beginning to change. I need to use that terminology, just beginning. But it wasn't there yet. I was one of the first black male teachers hired in the Barnstable Public Schools. And when people asked me, why'd you come here? I told them point blank, for an opportunity. Why? Don't I belong here? Well, you're not a Cape Codder, you're a Washashore. It took me a long time to figure out what a Washashore was. And I had, used to ask other people, well, where are you from? If I'm a Washashore, what are you? More importantly, we came here to help make some change. And Eugenia and Scover and Joe were already doing that before I got here. I just continued the momentum.
We're talking about the civil rights movement on Cape Cod and the life and legacy of Cape Cod's civil rights icon, Eugenia Forts. We'll have more after a break.
For the most part, you found prejudice in Martha's Vineyard. It might have been up on the roof looking down. It might have been underneath the seat or hanging around the doorway. But
the late Dean K. Denniston Sr. of Oak Bluffs.
There were certain jobs black people just did not get. You didn't see black people working in the stores. My brothers and I, we got jobs in the E&P and McNeil's, but we were behind the scenes. One of the first jobs I had was down in the basement trying to pick a chicken. I'll never forget that. I never did finish that one chicken. But you did not have black people, black guys, dealing with the public. You could work in the back room.
You're listening to WCAI, local public radio for the Cape, Coast, and Islands. Online at capeandislands.org.
You're listening to The Point. In honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're discussing the history of the civil rights movement on Cape Cod and the legacy of civil rights activist Eugenia Forts. With John Reed, president of the board of directors at Zion Union Heritage Museum and vice president of the Cape Cod chapter of the NAACP, he's also a retired history teacher at Barnstable High School, and Frank Scobah Rhodes, president of the Cape Cod chapter of the NAACP, former service member in the U.S. Air Force and retired school counselor in Falmouth. Scobah, you were raised in Falmouth from age 8. Do you have childhood memories of racism?
In retrospect, yes, I do. There are a few classifications of students, and I didn't fit any of them. My family moved here, and I was 8. By the time I was 14, the faculty always seated people alphabetically, so that there was a young lady in front of me and a young man behind me. But the three of us had this outside row of seats in every room we went to. And I had to deal with the people ahead of me or the people behind me. And I shouldn't talk to either one because that's just not what it's all about. We're not going to allow you to have so much fun that you can talk to the students around you just because you're getting good grades.
You moved south to Texas. What were your experiences there?
Oh, the easiest is to carry a 6-gauge gun that you carry on your hip because people will leave you alone. Under those circumstances, we hope.
We have another clip of Eugenia recalling segregation on the Cape.
In your early days in the Cape, was discrimination, other than the school segregation, a problem?
Yes, it was. But we were all so poor that we couldn't afford to go to the different places. In fact, I remember my father came here to help me with some work I had that he could do for me here at the house here. And I was taking him home, and he liked a beer now and then, and it was a hot day. And we stopped in Yarmouth, and he went into this place where they sold beer. It wasn't really a bar room, I guess you'd call it that, but it was small. And he came out, and he was very perturbed because they made him sit in a back room. He couldn't be served in the front. I'm glad you spoke of that, because I'd like to let that out, because it upset him so.
Do you recall any other situations such as that?
Yes, I had 2 tickets once given to me. The Masonic group here in Hyannis used to have dinners on Saturday nights years ago in the 30s. And I had 2 tickets given to me. And this person didn't realize that they segregated, wouldn't take you. So she gave me these two tickets, and this friend of mine and I went to the dinner, and we got as far as the door, and this was Henry Finney of Hyannis, who was one of the big Masons in town. He and his son Homer were taking tickets at the door, and he told me no, they would have to refund me the money because I couldn't come in.
The Cape in the 1930s was small town. Everybody knew everyone else. So what an embarrassment it must have been for Eugenia to be turned away by someone she knew. Now, do you remember situations like that? Did you experience situations like that yourselves?
Yes, mm-hmm. In my case. I was to buy a house and was told that I might like it in a different neighborhood better. And where I currently live at in Yarmouth, me and my wife are teachers. And people on the street in the beginning referred to us as the colored school teachers. I got offended by that one day, particularly when an older guy came up the street and I was out working in my yard. And he said, when you finish that, you can come on down and work in my yard. I looked at him and said, well, I'm not working in your yard. I got a job. Well, what do you do? I'm a teacher. Oh, you mean we have colored school teachers? The other part to that was he was upset because we got the house and he thought his daughter should have had the house. And let me know point blank that he doesn't know how we got the house or who we tricked into giving it to us. And I told him, I pay the bill every month. I don't want to hear what you have to say. Go on back down the street.
So I wonder, you mentioned earlier, John, that Eugenia kind of getting the Hyannis, New Bedford, and Boston and NAACP's kind of integrating that and getting everybody to kind of, I guess, know what everybody was working on. So how did you get involved with the NAACP? And then I want to hear, Scoba, your story, how you got involved.
They asked me to be the youth leader.
Yeah.
Since I worked at the high school, I became the youth advisor, the youth leader. So we started having meetings of young people, teenagers primarily, and we start taking them on trips to the conferences that Scoba was talking about, to the national convention, to other cultural items. I came to the conclusion that since I was from Boston, there was a lack of opportunity here for young people of color primarily. And to bridge the gap and fill in that void, I used to take them out of here every weekend somewhere, even if it was a day trip. So they got a chance to see something different than the Cape.
Mm. What about you, Scoba? How'd you get involved?
I got involved because my father was involved. When I got discharged from the service, I had a job that I went to work, but my dad was involved with the NAACP. And I said, you know, well, what do I need to do to get involved? And he said, well, why don't you come to a meeting? And that started the ball rolling.
What would you say some of the major accomplishments have been in your time with the NAACP here on the Cape?
Well, the segregation isn't as popular, I guess what I might call it, because there are towns where we are very small in population.
What do you think, John?
There are a lot of things we've done. We've helped to recruit teachers of color, and we're still doing that. We have our annual program on Martin Luther King Sunday, but we also partner with other groups where there's a program here in Woods Hole for Black History Month. Mm-hmm. There's a program in Orleans at Church of the Holy Spirit on Martin Luther King Monday. We have gone to court to help people. We have filed discrimination complaints on behalf of folks, and we're working energetically. We're still doing it. As Joe used to say, it would be a good time for the NAACP to go away. Well, in this current climate, it's more in demand now than it may have been back in the 30s.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what's coming up next.
We have one final clip of Eugenia Fortzett, and we want to thank Tales of Cape Cod for providing us with the audio from this 1978 interview. We'll put a link on our website, capeandislands.org, to the Tales of Cape Cod Oral History Project so you can take a listen. In this final clip, she talks about how the Cape was different from other parts of the country.
Was the Cape as bad as the rest of the country, or was it?
Well, no more. The only thing is, the rest of the country, they'd put out signs and they'd tell you, well, the Cape, the Main Street restaurants you could eat at in Hyannis But any of the inns and places, they wouldn't want you. No. You could go to Mayflower or the Dirty Spoon, as we used to call it, down near where the railroad station used to be. They'd serve you at the counter, you know. But the inns, or say like East Bay Lodge or those places, no, you couldn't. But we're ferreting them out. We're getting out. We're getting at them. And I hope before I die that it'll clear up much more.
So she says, I hope before I die it will clear up much more. So there have been changes since that recording was made in 1978 and her death in 2006. But since 2006, we've seen the election of the first African-American president. And in the last 2 years, we've seen white nationalism come out of the shadows. So what do you think Eugenia would make of the current political and social climate? And how do you think she'd be advocating for change today?
I don't think that she would be any different because of the way she was built in the first place. She didn't do what she did to try to get anybody to pat her on the back. It was saying, this is the right thing to do, period. They put in a monument to her on the ocean, and there are people who decided, no, we don't want her to have this. And they said, well, that's not your problem. You know, you go somewhere else to swim.
Yeah.
And she openly said, you did not make the ocean, God did. Eugenia was a unique individual, and she wasn't a wealthy person. If you used to see her, you would think she's your aunt or grandmother. But she wasn't one of these kind of people who did flamboyant things. I helped her out a lot. Mm-hmm. And to know her or to be sitting in her living room being taught how to be a Cape Codder, that's the other legacy I have for her. I used to sit in the living room, and she used to teach me what to do, what not to do, and what issues are still relevant. And it made me a better person. Yeah. Not only a teacher, but it made me a better community person, because when it was my turn to be president of the NAACP, I already knew the players and some of the pitfalls that you could fall into if you're not careful. Today, we have a problem. We see that the hands of progress are being turned backwards. In the name of whom? I don't really understand how a person who is not trained or sensitive can become the leader of the free world. And that's my own political piece. But as far as the everyday operations of people in the United States, we need to love each other a little bit more. We need to get away from the material possession because it's killing people. Mm. Some people believe you have money, you have power, you have class. Well, if you're poor and can do the work, she's an example.
Yeah. When you at the Cape 40 years versus today, 40 years ago versus today, what positive, I mean, there's obviously some positive changes in terms of civil rights and equality, and then what hasn't changed? So let's start with what, you know, I guess when she talked about the restaurants and things and, you know, service, that's changed. But what else? What else has changed over the last 40 years?
There's been plenty of change. You have people of color now working in jobs they could have never had before. They're living in places they never lived before. There's still a couple of tough communities, as Scover put it, but you have a different kind of dynamic about who comes to the Cape now. Mm-hmm. Some people lived in other places and moved down here to retire. Other people decide this is part of the commuter line, so they live here and work somewhere else. The newcomers come in with their own piece. They're not afraid to speak up. The early days, you had to be careful, you might say. Mm-hmm. As I was told, don't be so arrogant and flamboyant. Today, I may be considered meek, but I'm not. The bottom line is you do what you need to do and follow the process.
Yeah.
Because the process is not there for some people. It's there for all people.
There was a major rise in population, if you want to go back to the early 60s. There were friends who were taking young men, telling them to pack a suitcase because we're going to send you off on vacation. Put them on a bus and tell them to go to Hyannis. That's where you want to go. And there are a couple of women that might be stopping you when you get off the bus, but that's okay. You go on with them. They'll take good care of you.
No, I know this story. This is where they were bringing people in Washington, giving them a bus ticket to come here to Hyannis, saying they would have jobs and places to live. But wasn't true.
They started off in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Right.
And they were called Reverse Freedom Riders. That's what the name of them.
That's right.
That's what the article is about.
Yes.
Some of the families are still here today.
Yeah.
I taught most of the kids.
So tell us what happened when these folks got on this bus. They came here and they get off the bus and they find out this isn't true.
Well, first of all, they came in the middle of the night. Nobody knew they were coming. And when they landed at the bus station in Hyannis, the chief of police called Eugenia. She in turn called my other people, Margaret Mosley, Judy Barnett, Ken Warren, and they began to look for places to house folks. Initially, they lived on Otis Air Force Base in the barracks, the World War II barracks, let me correct that. And from there, they began to resettle in different towns. Now, it's kind of interesting because some of the children at that time are my age. The younger ones, I taught at Marshall High School. So when I heard the story, I thought it was insane. But PBS came to the museum to verify that. I have all the articles, I have the material involved with it, and I still know who the families are.
Yeah. Not all of them stayed, though. Some of them did leave.
A lot of them left.
Yeah. As a country, what do you see as the most pressing or important changes that we still need to make to guarantee equality and civil rights today?
I think that as long as the young people decide that we're going to follow the rules, because it's important for us to do that, would be a positive movement towards equality on the Cape.
Education, job opportunity, housing, doing something about the opioid question. You got to give people an opportunity to uplift, not just stare at the status quo, or look at other things as an easy means of getting ahead in life. Life is not easy. It's rather difficult. And everybody struggles. But if you don't have opportunity, you don't have anything.
Yeah. Like Eugenia, you both have been active within the community as educators with the NAACP and elsewhere. Do you see the next generation stepping up and engaging as your younger selves and Eugenia did?
It's a tough question to answer with some of the frustrations that are going on out there.
We do have young people who come to the meetings, though, and they are on the board, and we encourage them to participate. We're recruiting. So if anybody out there is listening right now and you're under the age of 50, we're looking for you. I mean, there's work for everybody. It's not just for a handful of us.
Right. What would you say to the next generation about the importance of activism and community engagement?
Well, I'm an active member in the Democratic State Party. So it's like, that's one way to go. But on the other hand, we live in a community. We're taxpayers. We have the right to say something, too. We have the right to ask for and demand things be done that benefit the people. Not just the people who are in power. Everybody. Because you have to teach people sometime what they don't know. And that becomes important. When people come to us, we try to resolve the situation, but also give them an era of hope. This is what else you can do, not just the resolution to your problem. So when you walk out the door, you're a better person for coming than you were before you came.
Yeah. So, but what do you think about the next generation, the importance of activism and community engagement? What would you tell them?
You don't like what's going on? Then get yourself together and change it.
Where does the Black Lives Matter movement fit into the civil rights movement?
It's a component of mainly young people, mainly urban people, and even on the Cape, there are a few members of Black Lives Matter. They're expressing their own opinion. They want to make sure their issues don't get lost in the mainstream or people don't take them seriously. You could compare Black Lives Matter to almost the Black Panthers of the 60s and ask yourself a question, why come the Black Panthers? Well, everybody didn't agree with the Black Panthers, but they made a statement, though. And Black Pride became part of the outcome of that statement. So you didn't have to put your head down acting like you weren't just as good, that you may be better in some cases and did not know it.
Now, John, you sort of touched on this, but Scope, I want to ask you what your thoughts are on how civil rights will advance, or if they can advance, under the current administration.
Oh, they're going to have a hard time to make advancements under the current administration. That population is going to have to create some changes. And people are going to have to start believing what they're teaching isn't quite appropriate.
You know, I'm just thinking, I am not a person of color, but I feel frustration. And I imagine that after all the work that you have done, you have to be feeling some frustration right now. And John, I know you talked about hope and optimism. Are you optimistic?
Oh, I'm optimistic because I can't wait to November. I mean, we're ready for change right now. I'm not going to say impeach a person, but I'm going to say look at what has been done in 1 year and ask yourself, are you part of that or you want something different? And if you want something different, start working right now.
Scoba, final thoughts from you?
I think that there is some faith that I have in young people.
We'll have a link with more information about Eugenia Forts, the Cape Cod chapter of the NAACP, and some Martin Luther King Jr. events happening around the region at our website, capeandislands.org. I want to thank you both so much for coming in, John Reed and Frank Scoba Rhodes. Thanks for coming in and sharing your thoughts and memories with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking.
Coming up after a break, young people share how the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. serves as an inspiration and influences their hopes and dreams for the future.
There were a lot of people of color that came to Martha's Vineyard to work during the summertime. And it was an event to go to church on a Sunday evening.
Dean K. Denniston Sr., son of the first African-American minister on Martha's Vineyard.
There was a man in Oak Bluffs that ran a sightseeing bus from Oak Bluffs to Gay Head, just as they do now. Only I think those days it was either 50 cents or a dollar for a round trip. And in order to make it easy for people to get to Sunday night service, my father made a deal with this man, George Bernard, who had this bus. He would pick up these people without transportation that wanted to come to the service, sit there and wait for them, and after the service was over, he'd deliver them back home. And he made $5.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You're listening to The Point. Young people today continue to be inspired by the life and legacy of Dr. King. Up next, the poem a 14-year-old chose to read at a Martin Luther King Jr. parade.
Hello, my name is Malik Barrios. I'm 14 years old, and as a young black male, I'm very concerned with what's happening in the world today. All over the world, we have people echoing, "Hands up, don't shoot." And even in New York, people are shouting, "We can't breathe." Even in Albuquerque, we are marching through our streets chanting, "No justice, no peace." It's clear that something must change, and I know that we want the same thing, freedom and peace. In 1949, Langston Hughes was a young man just like myself, and he wrote a poem that explains how many of us feel today. The poem's title is Democracy. Democracy will not come today, this year, nor ever through compromise and fear. I have as much right as the other fellow has to stand on my own 2 feet and own the land. I tire so of hearing people say, "Let things take their course. Tomorrow is another day." I do not need my freedom when I am dead. I cannot live off of tomorrow's bread. Freedom is a strong seed planted in a great need. I live here too. I want freedom just as you.
That was 14-year-old Malik Barrios. In 2013, Generation Justice youth producer Arturo Castillo won the Martin Luther King Jr. Multicultural Council Scholarship for his commentary on how Martin Luther King Jr. continues to inspire him and his generation.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
My name is Arturo Castillo, and I am 17 years old, and I attend South Valley Academy. Everybody can be great because anybody can serve. To me, Dr. King was a liberator. He saw the injustices in the world and fought for equity. From joining the bus boycotts because of Rosa Parks' arrest, to the formation of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to the deliverance of the famous I Have a Dream speech, Dr. King made a difference in the world. He has inspired me to advocate for equal education for all students. To understand how Dr. King influenced me, it is necessary to examine my family's history. Jumping high walls, traveling by foot for miles, and getting drenched while crossing a river, these are all the obstacles my parents encountered as they journeyed to the United States. My father left Mexico when he was 17 years old. On his voyage, my dad did not eat for 3 days. He only had water and a hope of reaching the promised land. Similarly, my mother crossed the Rio Grande alone with her one-year-old son. Like Dr. King, my parents never gave up. They were persistent in creating a better life, not for themselves, but for their children. My parents risked their lives and left behind their home in Mexico and everything they had so that my siblings and I would have access to a better education. Dr. King saw inequality in the world and fought for change. My parents pursued equal opportunities for their children, just as Dr. King strove for equality amongst all people. Never losing sight of the sacrifices my parents made, I have dedicated my life to my personal education while fully being committed to education equity. I believe every single person has the right to receive an education. I am involved with the New Mexico Youth Alliance, a youth council that works to promote youth voice and engagement. With the Youth Alliance, I have participated in many projects that endorse education equity. I was involved in Dropping In, a student-driven play that focused on New Mexico's 50% high school dropout rate and gave youth perspectives as to why students struggle to stay in school, such as poverty, racism, underage drinking, lack of parent involvement, teenage pregnancy, and lack of school support. Last month, I served as a youth keynote speaker at the Public Education as a Human Right rally, where the Mexican American Latino Defense Education Fund established a lawsuit against the state to demand educational success for all students, in particular, students of color. My actions today are a representation of my beliefs. Dr. King promoted change where he saw injustices, segregation, prejudice, and discrimination. He acted upon these issues to ensure they would not affect future generations. I too hope to be remembered as a youth activist, a scholar, and a fighter. A fighter who fought for education because, like my father said, la educación es lo único que uno le puede dejar a sus hijos. Así que recuerda, te pueden quitar todo lo que tienes, mijo, pero tu educación nadie te la quita. Ultimately, the only inheritance one can leave their child is education. So remember, they can take everything from you, but no one can take away your education.
That was 17-year-old Generation Justice producer Arturo Castillo. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.